Good morning.
Good morning.
2 million years ago, on a balmy summer morning, about 9 a.m., primitive man took a break from scratching his chest and said, "Let's see now. I've taken my morning constitutional, gathered enough nuts and berries and bones for today's food. Jane and I did our bit to propagate the species, and now I've spent the last 15 minutes scratching myself, and I've only been up for an hour. What else is there? What's the meaning of life? If I don't come up with some kind of theory, it's going to be just another night watching the stars with the guys with nothing to say but hern, hern." But the question was too vast and swampy. It swallowed the man in a psychedelic swirl. Also, some of the berries he'd eaten were mildly poisonous. And the question drove him insane until the stars came out and he said to his friends, "Ride the snake to the ancient lake." And they all shook their heads and said, "Hern, hern." That man had opened the door to an avalanche closet. I don't know if any of you here have an avalanche closet in your house. We do. Our house has many doors that open into different rooms, but there's one that you open it and a biblical flood of stuff comes rolling out, engulfing the entire hall in a primeval swamp of outgrown baby clothes, lonely baby, lonely shoes, and slithering extension cords. And unfortunately, this door is right next to the bathroom door, always waiting to engulf some confused house guest. Once the door is opening, there is no closing it without a snow shovel. Really, we should call it Pandora. You get it? Pandora? What's the meaning of life? It was an avalanche closet. Don't turn the knob unless you're ready for a swim in the murky mix of what we would call science, religion, politics. Any one of them a daunting topic alone, but for millions of years, they mingled together in a swampy jambalaya called culture. About 10,000 years ago, some tribe came up with an experiment. They decided to remodel nature's house, an immense and terrifying task that we've not yet finished because it turns out Mother Nature never throws anything away. She just kind of stews in it. But turning this swamp shack into a shopping mall seemed like a good idea at the time. And one thing that had to be dealt with was the avalanche closet, the meaning of life. And these early people eventually did what my wife and I will do with our avalanche closet someday. They set up dividers, a handy shelf system. They divided meaning into science, religion, and politics so that these could be dealt with one at a time. They still shared the same closet, but they were more manageable that way, and religion was on the top shelf. About 200 years ago, certain thinkers were digging around in the shelves of science, economics, and gender studies, and every so often they would say, "Aha," jump up and slam their head on that top shelf called religion. And they began to ask, "Why does that big shelf need to be on top, slamming me on the head every time I get an idea? Religion has been lording it like a king for too long. It is time that science and politics declared their independence." Certain thinkers began to feel that religion was getting in the way of the search for the meaning of life. Religion was even getting in the way of the quest to understand God. This event is known as the Great Enlightenment. Had the Enlightenment thinkers attempted to assassinate God, religion would have had the high ground, easy to mobilize the impoverished faithful to fight against an attempted siege. But the intellectuals were hatching a plan to break God out of the great stone cathedrals, tunneling under the scriptural foundations of the church to rescue God from religion. This put the religious leaders on the low ground. So they hatched a plan to regain the high ground by girding their loins, grabbing shovels, and digging for the proof. Archaeology burst onto the scene in the 19th century, but it wasn't only tomb raiders looking for King Tut's gold. It was also true believers digging for evidence of the Bible as fact. As Sir James Frazer observed, the field of geology was invaded by an army of theologians. The results were, of course, disappointing. The tree of knowledge, Noah's ark, and the cross Jesus died on were all made of wood, which doesn't generally last for thousands of years. Jerusalem had been destroyed twice, and the Ark of the Covenant was not found until Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark, which turned out to be only a movie. Besides which, any actual relics or remains in Israel had long since been looted and sold on the Lucky Charm market to become idols and amulets. Martin Luther once said that on a trip to the Vatican, he saw enough nails from the true cross to shoe every horse in Europe. What the pious archaeologists turned up instead were bones, not the bones of Adam and Abraham, but the fossilized remains of giant monsters. These they called dinosaurs, meaning terrible lizards, because seriously, anything that big must have been a jerk. And the most dangerous of them was named the Tyrannosaurus Rex, tyrant, lizard, king, on the assumption that he must have legislated unjust tax laws and partied like Jim Morrison. I wish we had a Tyrannosaurus Rex with us today so he could say, "What? I kill, I eat. It's not like anybody listens to my political opinions. Why do you have to call me tyrant king? Why can't you call me something cool like Hunt-O-Matic or the Terminator? I'm not even technically a lizard." But now I'm glad we don't have the Tyrannosaurus Rex with us today, because we would never get him to shut up, and we've got to stay on topic. The biggest problem with discovering the dinosaur bones is that they were found to be much older than the human race and, gasp, older than the earth itself. Since Bible scholars had long since established the first day of creation, October 23rd, 4,004 years before the Christ. Now, these bones were demonstrating that they were millions of years old, and there was a simple explanation for this. God had fabricated the bones in order to test humanity's faith. Most people since have failed that test, myself included. Religion's fleeting honeymoon with archaeology ended in a very sober annulment, and the clerics became fond of quoting Ecclesiastes 1:18, "In much wisdom is much vexation, and those who increase knowledge increase sorrow." So the borrowed shovels were returned to the nerds who have gone on digging for God's works, regardless of how they may contradict God's word. Of course, some true believers are still digging for proof of the Bible as fact. This is called pseudo-archaeology, pseudo meaning spurious, fallacious, fake. And in a supreme irony that must surely give God a smirk, pseudo-archaeology sells about 1,000 times more books than real archaeology. When we first moved here, one of Elizabeth's medical co-workers asked me what I was going to do for work. Fresh out of seminary, I said I was going to be an itinerant Bible teacher like Jesus, to which this doctor responded, "Uh-huh, and then what are you going to do for work?" Because doctors know that these days a doctor's husband can't stay at home darning socks anymore. So I said, "Well, my degree in Bible study also certifies me to teach biology in public schools." And that doctor never spoke to me again. Because either they didn't get the joke, or more likely, because they did. The dinosaur debacle turned out to be a minor embarrassment compared with the Darwinian disaster. The 1859 publication of On the Origin of Species brought the conflict to a whole new level. It was fine to say that the first human beings were molded from dirt, but the idea of humans originating as bacteria was just too undignified. Religion would have been happy to play the old game of Inquisition, which in this case would have been called guerrilla warfare. Eh? But the separation of church and state had become a divorce. Yes, a fairly amicable divorce, but one of the terms was that if the church publicly murdered another scientist, she might as well use her one phone call on God, because the state was not going to bail her out again. The scariest thing about evolution is that it's not over yet. Having once been a monkey is a scary thought, but most of us have recovered from the shock. Actually, it explains kind of a lot. Far more terrifying is that not every species continues to evolve. Some are eliminated by natural selection. Surely, the Creator loved the dinosaur and the dodo bird, but God did not break the law of natural selection for them, and might not break the law of natural selection for us. According to Darwin's theories, if we refuse to evolve, we could become extinct, which would be doubly embarrassing for us because we as human beings don't only evolve physically, we also evolve intellectually and technologically. We've got all sorts of ways to adapt to new circumstances. The question is, will we? And will we adapt in a way that works? Because adaptation, particularly our technological adaptations, have not always been geared toward long-term survival. Exhibit A, the spork. After the discovery of dinosaur bones and the Darwinian theories in the 19th century, peering into the shadowy past lost some of its appeal. Let's remember that people were just coming out of the Dark Ages, rubbing their eyes, adjusting to the Enlightenment, and far more interested in the bright future, which you could see at all hours because of the electric light. Instead of cowering in the dark after nightfall, people could finally light their homes all of the time. Of course, the cost was that you could no longer see sunlight during the day because of all of the black smoke produced by the Industrial Revolution. And while the clerics never tired of arguing that Adam and Eve were not apes, the captains of industry took the wheel and decided evolution was just fine. When we look at the telegraph, then the telephone, the television, and then the telescreen, which people have been fooled into calling the internet, what else could we call it but evolution? Natural selection. What the majority of consumers select starts to seem natural, and then it becomes a fossil when something smaller and faster comes along. Carriages evolved into cars, fire evolved into fluorescent lights, piano-playing daughters evolved into vinyl records, and nerds evolved into billionaires. This oversimplification leaves out the true engine of technological evolution, the military-industrial complex, always looking for a bigger bang, a quicker, cleaner kill, a better bloodbath, a maximum massacre. Consumers get great toys, computers, and remote-controlled cars, and hair dryers, whatever. But these are always hand-me-downs from Big Brother, who gets the bigger, better toys, and with guns on them. We get fireworks on the 4th of July, but the big boys have learned how to split an atom for the ultimate weapon of mass extortion. For a while in the 1990s, it was cool to talk about saving the environment so that our bodies could still live there. But that fad got old. And in the 21st century, it's become more fashionable to abandon our bodies, evacuate the atmosphere, and go live in the data sphere. When I grow up, I'm going to be a Facebook page. Of course, the data sphere is full of pollution too, but at least you don't have to smell it. And so our biological body becomes something to take photographs of, splash them on the internet, so that you can wake up in the middle of the night wondering who you are. Quick, do a Google search of your own name. Ah, I am a celebrity. Oh, that's right, I'm also my private paparazzi. Better take a picture. Long ago, standing in this very spot, I said that my house has an avalanche closet. Now I realize that there are two. One literal avalanche closet in the hallway, and another avalanche closet in my head, which I just opened up and dumped all this mess on the floor. How embarrassing. What we're looking at? Digging up dinosaur bones, questioning human origins, developing weapons. We could boil that down to ability and responsibility, what we can do and what we must do. The ability to probe the mysteries of creation, regardless of what our sacred stories might say. Just because we can do it doesn't mean that we must. This argument continues to this day, and I don't claim the authority to end it. We are human beings. Our potential is incredible. William Shakespeare wrote, "What a piece of work is man, how noble in reason, how infinite in faculties, in form and movement, how express and admirable." in action how like an angel, in apprehension how like a god, the beauty of this world, the paragon of animals. We are all of these things. We can explore the past. We can exploit or digitally escape the present. We can explode the future. But because we can, does that mean that we must? If we pride ourselves on being the culmination of history, is it our responsibility to defend that claim by ending history? I hope not. We, human beings, are famous in the animal world for our can-do attitude. Unfortunately, we're famous the way that Billy the Kid and Joseph Stalin are famous. Still, it's good to be famous. No other animal does can-do like we do. And no other animal has such a hard time distinguishing can-do from must-do. Our cultural can-do attitude has led to incredible achievements and incredible danger. Disappearing into a virtual world, leaving our bodies to bloat and rot in front of digital screens, that is something that humanity can do. Splitting atoms, blooming flowers of destruction that you can see from outer space, that is something that humanity can do. The primitive man and woman from 2 million years ago could witness either of these bright, colorful spectacles and be amazed at what humanity can do. Their biggest goal was just to keep the species alive for another generation. And they succeeded. We know it, because here we are. I say, let's see if we can do what they did. Keep this species alive for another generation. And anything that we could do on top of that, we'll call that progress. Let's show that primitive man and woman what humanity can do. Thank you.